Olivet Discourse, Part 2, the second talk in a series on the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24 and 25, was presented by Ron Julian on July 7, 1996, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
We are looking for a couple of weeks at Matthew 24, maybe into 25. The so-called Olivet Discourse. And I told you last week that I always have something of a quandary these days, because on the one hand, I really believe that the Bible is teaching that our great hope as believers is the return of Jesus, the second coming of Christ to finally defeat the enemies of God and to rule over creation, to make everything the way it was ultimately intended to be. Sin and evil and death defeated, and life finally being holy and sweet the way God has ultimately intended it to be from the beginning. So that's our great hope. And it's not surprising that the Bible talks about it in those terms. Peter is saying that, urging us to fix our hope completely on the grace to be revealed to us when Jesus returns. And Paul talking about believers as those who long for his appearing. So all of that is true, and it is true for me at this point in my life. I'm looking forward to that day with great eagerness. The problem is that I would like to get enthusiastic about all of the talk about the second coming that goes on out there, but my problem is that I don't find very much of it convincing. I'm not yet convinced that the model that you hear in the most popular teaching on the second coming, I'm not really convinced that that model is true. And one of the passages that is often used to try to support that model is the Olivet Discourse. And so last week I started talking about what seems to me to be going on in this admittedly difficult passage. But this is Jesus' main teaching on the question of the second coming. That's not all he talks about, but if you want to go to a place where he addresses the end of the age, this is one of those fundamental passages where he does that. And my argument so far has been that in order to understand this passage, we have to realize what it is that Jesus set out to do. And in particular, what he set out to do was to answer the disciples' questions concerning the destruction of Jerusalem, which Jesus had predicted. He had said that concerning the temple, that not one stone would be left upon another. And naturally, the disciples were interested in, well, when is that going to happen? It also seems that in their minds, they had connected together the event of the destruction of the temple with the final consummation of the kingdom of God. As good Jews, they were aware that there was a promised kingdom, that the Messiah was going to come and rule over that kingdom. Jesus had already entered in triumph into Jerusalem with the crowds yelling acclaim. And it's not surprising that the disciples would have this idea that this all must be just about ready to happen. We must be ready to go here. And so it seems in this context that they have connected in their minds the triumphal final consummation of the kingdom with these events of the destruction of the temple that Jesus had described. And part of Jesus' purpose, his fundamental purpose in this teaching, I think, is to address their question and to explain to them the sense in which It's true that these events that he's describing were soon to happen, and the sense in which it might very well not be true that those events were soon to happen. Part of what's hard for us, I think, and I know it was hard for me when I was a young Christian and I was really interested in prophetic things in a very naive and foolish way, I think. I mean, I'm embarrassed at the things I was doing with the Bible at that time. But one of the things that can sort of get a hold of you is, well, I want this passage to be telling me things about my future. I mean, I already know what happened in the past. I don't need anybody to tell me what happened in the past. I want somebody to tell me how's it going to happen here in the future. And so our tendency is to take a passage like this and to start pulling out everything that Jesus says and assume that it is a description of things that are going to happen in our future. And what I started to argue last week is that I don't think that's the case. That he has set out to answer their question concerning when is the destruction of the temple going to happen. He starts out by telling them that they should expect that there's some time to come here when they are going to experience suffering. They are going to go out proclaiming the gospel. The gospel is going to be preached to all the nations. They are going to be taken before governors and kings and have to give an account of themselves. In other words, preparing his disciples specifically for the idea that the kingdom is not about to enter into this world like tomorrow. You should not get the idea that you don't really need to get any groceries in because the whole thing is done. That's not the way it's going to happen. And for you particularly, he's saying to them, you need to understand that you have a lot facing you here, a lot that you're going to have to deal with. Finally, he starts to talk about a very famous section where he talks about the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place and telling the people in Judea to flee to the mountains and pray that your flight may not be on a Sabbath and so on. I'm certainly familiar with many teachings on the end times that would say that's a description of events in our future. The temple is going to be rebuilt in Jerusalem. A figure called the Antichrist is going to set himself forth there as a figure of worship. And at that time, when you see that happen, then get out of Jerusalem because big things are about to happen. And fundamentally, what I'm arguing from this passage is a very simple thing. It seems to me that this is the very topic that Jesus set out to talk about in the beginning of this when they asked him, when is it that the temple is going to be destroyed? This is when he talks about it. They ask him, what is the sign that these things are going to happen? Well, it's this. As he says in Luke, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is at hand. I'm saying, there is a day coming when armies will be surrounding this place, and what I have prophesied to you, the destruction of the temple, is about to happen. And when you see this, when you see the armies gathering, I would get out as fast as possible because this is what's going to happen. So my fundamental conclusion about this passage is that teaching there in the middle that talks about the abomination of desolation and all of that is not describing something that's in my future and your future, but it is describing something that happened in 70 AD, a generation down the line from when Jesus predicted these things. That's at the heart of my understanding of this whole passage. So, if you don't buy the idea that it's reasonable to think that he actually is answering the question that they asked him about when it was that the temple was going to be destroyed, then you're not going to find my reconstruction of this passage compelling. But to me, that's the bottom line. That's the thing that makes the most sense. I want to come back here in a minute to talk about this idea of this great tribulation that he describes as happening when the city is destroyed. I'll come back to that in a minute. But Let me just say that I think what he has done is basically described the destruction of Jerusalem, and as he concludes that section in Luke, he says, "They will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled." Pretty clear exposition. Jerusalem is going to be destroyed and trampled underfoot by the nations until the times of the Gentiles, the times of the nations, are fulfilled. We need to, I think to get the impact of this, we need to remember to whom Jesus is talking and what the significance of this would be. The land of Israel, the land of Judea there, was promised to the people of Israel. They were brought into it miraculously. They lived there for many years. But following a time of great rebellion and apostasy against God, the Babylonians had come in and led the people into captivity for 70 years. And even after they came back, they were under one government for another for a great period of time. Except for one period of time since the Babylonian captivity, when they actually had autonomy and were not under any other government. They were variously under the heel of the Babylonians and the Persians and the Greeks under Alexander the Great, and now they were under the heel of the Romans. God had made great promises to Israel that He was going to save them, that He was going to be their God, that they would be free from their enemies. And yet here Jesus is basically saying that that time is not yet to happen. What you might expect, you know, I'm the Messiah, I'm here, the promises that God made to Israel seemingly ought to be about to come about. But what He's saying basically is, no, I'm the Messiah and I'm here, but the fact is that this place is going to be destroyed and the people of Israel are going to be kicked out. And they will not be here in this land. They will not have Jerusalem as their city until the time of the Gentiles be fulfilled. It's a tremendously significant thing He's saying in the light of the promises to Israel. And I think that's part of what we have to understand in this passage, is the significance of what He's saying is really in the light of salvation history. I think when He talks about the great tribulation that comes upon the nation there, you might hear arguments that would say, well, He has to be talking about something in our future, because there are lots of, terrible things that have happened that have been as bad as what happened to Israel when the Romans captured the city in 70 AD. I think, though, that that's missing part of what it is that Jesus is doing. It's true that there have been times of suffering all through the history of mankind, but I think what He's getting at here is, look, we're looking at something that could have totally eradicated the Jews as the people of God altogether, the ones who have had these promises. The Babylonians were bad, the Persians were bad, the Greeks were bad, but I'm telling you, what's going to happen here is such that, this is devastation. And if it hadn't stopped, we're talking about the end of everything, the end of all of the promises that God has been making from the beginning to them. So that what makes it this great tribulation is that of all of the judgments that God has ever brought on Israel through the various nations that have come upon them, this is by far the worst. This is by far the most serious. And the consequences were most long-lasting, because it's been 2,000 years and they had no place to go. The history of the Jews as a people with no homeland of their own, and yet somehow managing to survive as a people, as a distinctive racial identity, is truly a tremendous story in the history of the world. I think we have to think about it in those terms. Okay, well, let's see how far we can get into the rest of this here then. We're in Matthew 24. Let me start with verse 23. I'm going to come back into some of these other things here in a minute, but let's start with verse 23 for now. "Then if anyone says to you, 'Behold, here is the Christ,' or 'There he is,' do not believe him. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and will show great signs and wonders so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I have told you in advance. If therefore they say to you, behold, he is in the wilderness, do not go forth. Or behold, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe them. For just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. So, in this section, he has said that this great tribulation is going to come, destruction is going to come upon the city of Jerusalem. Now, in the light of that, I think what he's doing is he is saying, in the light of this, and that these things are going to happen, there is going to come then this period of time before the end finally comes, before Jesus does return in actuality to bring in the kingdom, the possibility that others would come along and basically mislead you into thinking, I'm the one, I'm here. And what he seems to be doing here is to be warning us in advance about the sort of thing that somebody would come along and say, and that it can't be true. What he's saying is, look, if somebody comes along and says, oh, the Messiah, he's back, he's over, he's living out in the wilderness, or come and we'll meet him in this place, what he's saying is you can know in advance that it's not me. This is not the return of the Messiah, because I'll tell you exactly how I'm coming back. It's like the lightning that flashes from the east even to the west. It's the sort of thing that gets known immediately everywhere at the same time. So you're not going to have to go and seek him out, because he's coming for you. I mean, basically is the idea. So a warning in advance that someone might come along and make a claim to be the Christ, but it's not going to happen that way. So if somebody comes to you and says, Jesus has come back and he's over here and we can go meet him, you can know in advance that that's not true. Because what Jesus is saying is, that's not the way I'm going to do it. I don't know. He talks about this showing great signs and wonders so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. It's possible that he has in mind here the figure that sometimes is referred to as the Antichrist. It's not clear. I mean, he's not talking about any one specific person or any one specific time. But the fact is, I think the Bible does teach about a figure at the end times, an opponent of God who tries to mislead people through signs and wonders. The passage that seems to be the clearest about that is in 2 Thessalonians of Paul, where he speaks in verse 3 of the man of lawlessness, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called god or object of worship. And down in verse 8, then that lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. That is, the one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders, and with all the deception of wickedness for those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. So there, Paul seems to have, unless I'm missing something, he seems to have someone clearly in mind, an individual, someone who comes about at the end of the age when Jesus comes back personally to put an end to him, and he talks about these signs and wonders to mislead people. So it's possible that Jesus has the same thing in mind here when he talks about signs and wonders so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. What is clear is that he's warning us, he's telling us the nature of his return so that we're bolstered against any sort of false claims. Then in verse 29, but immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. I want to hold off on that immediately after the tribulation of those days for a minute. If you're following what I'm saying, you might have a question about what that means, because I've already said that the tribulation of those days is something that came about when the Romans sacked Jerusalem in 70 AD. But let's forget about that part for a minute and just talk about the picture that he's painting here. He makes a reference to two, at least I think, well, I guess you could say three. It's very common in the prophets to have the day of the Lord, that final day of God's judgment, pictured in terms of the sun being darkened and the moon not giving its light. So Jesus is using language that recalls what the prophets had said about that. He says all the tribes of the earth will mourn, which is language that he has borrowed from Zechariah at 12:10, in Zechariah 12:10. And I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication, so that they will look on me whom they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only son. So this language about the tribes mourning is language that is borrowed from Zechariah, where the day of the Lord, that day of God's return and God's judgment, is pictured with the people of Israel looking upon whom they have pierced, God himself essentially in the language there, and mourning over their rebellion and their evil in the past, is what I understand it to be saying. Jesus is taking that language and essentially applying it to his own return. And lest we miss that that's what is actually happening there, it's interesting that in the book of Revelation, right at the beginning, we see that language picked up in verse 7. Behold, he is coming with the clouds, and every eye will see him, even those who pierced him, and all the tribes of the earth will mourn over him. That's that language from Zechariah of the tribes mourning and looking upon the one whom they pierced, and he's applying it specifically to Jesus. The other language that he's picking up on here, we also just saw in Revelation. Behold, he is coming with the clouds. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. I believe that this is a reference to a very famous section in Daniel. I'm going the wrong way here. Daniel. There we go. Daniel chapter 7, where Daniel is given a vision. He sees this vision of the four beasts, and each beast represents a different empire that the Israelites were going to deal with. But as a part of this vision, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming. And he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. So it's a very famous passage from the Old Testament speaking of the Messiah. The Jews understood it as a messianic passage, coming with the clouds of heaven, glory, and all of that. It seems clear that he's making an allusion to that. So this language here is really pregnant language. He's borrowing from a number of places in the Old Testament, places that his disciples as Jews and other Jewish readers of the time would have understood as being messianic references from the Old Testament. This is the time when it all happens. This is what we're waiting for, that time when the day of God comes, the Messiah enters into his glory, the tribes mourn over their past rebellion and look on him whom they have pierced, and so on. So this here, I think, really truly is language that is describing something that is in our future, and that day that we are looking for, the day when Jesus returns in glory, when he comes to rule. And he's suggesting that there are signs that in the heavens. Luke puts it, there will be signs in sun and moon and stars, and upon the earth dismay among nations, in perplexity at the roaring of the sea and the waves, men fainting from fear and the expectation of the things which are coming upon the world, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken, and then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Okay, so we have, from my perspective, we have a very clear progression. Israel, the nation is destroyed, Jerusalem is destroyed, the people are led out into captivity. There is a period of time where you need to beware that you aren't led astray by false Christs waiting for His return. But finally the day will come when He will return, and His sign will be in the sky, and He will come with power and great glory. The question is, how do we get from one to the other? What's the connection between this section that talks about the abomination of desolation and the great tribulation and all of that, and this passage which seems clearly to be talking about Jesus' return, the day that we are eagerly waiting for? It sort of hinges around that phrase, immediately after the tribulation of those days. And there are some people who would argue, well, since it's immediately after the tribulation that Jesus returns, the tribulation must be something that is still to happen in our future. And so we'll have this tribulation, abomination of desolation, and so on. Then immediately Jesus will return. But I've already argued that I don't think that it's reasonable to say that. That Jesus set out to talk about the destruction of Jerusalem, which happened in 70 AD, and I think that's exactly what he described. So why does he say immediately after the tribulation of those days? There are several answers that people give. One is, Jesus thought that he was going to come back immediately after the destruction of Jerusalem, but he was wrong. And many people have used this, I mean, it's a very reasonable way of putting the passage together. The destruction of Jerusalem, and then he comes back immediately afterwards. So, since he didn't get it right, he must not have been the Messiah, huh? He must have just been a fake, a quack, who painted himself to be the Messiah, predicted his immediate return, and then died and disappeared. I don't know. That doesn't seem like a good option to me. Maybe that... So, since I'm convinced that he is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, there are only a couple of possibilities, and I have gone back and forth. One possibility is that the tribulation that he's describing is still going on. That in fact, this whole period of time since the Jews were kicked out of their homeland is essentially all part of this great tribulation that has come upon them. And sometimes I have been inclined to think that's true. In fact, last time I taught on this stuff, that was what I was leaning toward at the time. And that's possible. There's some things I like about that. But on the other hand, another possibility is, and this is something that we need to take into account, this idea that immediately after implies... I mean, that language to us in English sounds like it's saying, you know, as soon as you see the destruction of Jerusalem, then you need to know that, you know, it's just minutes away, or hours away, maybe. That it's implying some sort of period of time that's going to be short. But as I look at this Greek word that's used in that spot, it's not at all clear that that's what the word means. It's used in places in the Gospels to describe things, one thing following immediately after the other, which clearly do not happen one immediately after the other. There's an intervening time. So I'm inclined to think that the word may have a different sense than immediately, as in nothing else happened. You know, you took one breath and this happened, and then on the next breath something else happened, but is implying more a more logical relationship between them. And in other words, you're asking me two questions. You're asking me about the destruction of Jerusalem, and you're asking me about the end of the age and when all of that comes about. I'm telling you the order of events. First, Jerusalem is destroyed, and afterwards comes the tribulation of those... Afterwards comes the sign of the Son of Man and the return of Christ and all of that. Somehow, if that's the case, then it would seem like we would want to have Jesus explain that the coming of the Romans to destroy Jerusalem is something that could be happen sometime, and in fact will happen in their lifetime, but his return is uncertain. It's not at all clear when it is he's going to come back or how long it would be after those things that he's going to come back. And in fact, I think that's what we find in the next section. That the section that is always giving people fits and trying to figure out what he means when he talks about this generation, I think has a very natural and easy way of understanding it if we have this sort of picture. So let's look at verse 32 then. Now learn the parable from the fig tree. I'm going to go there. I know I skipped verse 21, but 31, but let's go to verse 32. Now learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and put forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. Even so you too, when you see all these things, recognize that he is near, right at the door. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my word shall not pass away. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven nor the Son, but the Father alone. For the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. For as in those days, which were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, they were marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. So shall the coming of the Son of Man be. And let me just stop there. I think what he's saying here, this is difficult for us to get a hold of, because I think we are inclined to think about this language that he's saying something that he's not. He's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, and he's talking about the final events. Now learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and put forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. Even so you too, when you see all these things, recognize that he is near, right at the door. What are all these things that he's talking about? And here's what my argument would be. He's talking about the connection between the destruction of Jerusalem that they have asked about and the final events, which he has described. If we interpret all these things as being seeing the sign of the Son of Man in the sky and the angels are gathering up the elect and everything, when you see all these things, recognize he is near, that would be hardly worth saying. I mean, you see the sign of the Son of Man in the sky and say, recognize he is near, right at the door. I mean, I don't think I need him to tell me that at that point. I think what he's saying is, when you see all these things, the things that you asked about, the armies surrounding Jerusalem and the temple being destroyed and the very things that I predicted, when you see all these things, recognize that he is near, right at the door. I went and looked at the places in the Bible that talk about him being near, his return being near. When you look at those places, in the other places in the Bible where his appearance is described as being near, it's described as being near now. You look at, for instance, at the end of James, where that very similar language is used in James 5, where he says, "Do not complain, brethren, against one another that you yourselves may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing right at the door." That language about being near at the door, I think, is not language that is suggesting it's going to happen in a minute. But it is language that suggests it is imminent. It could happen at any time. He's near, he's there at the door. At any moment, the door could open. In other words, what he's saying about the events surrounding the destruction of Jerusalem is, until Jerusalem is destroyed, you know that the kingdom of God is not ready to happen yet. Speaking to his disciples there, because those events still have to happen the way I predicted them. But when they happen, when the destruction has come down the way I have predicted it, then you know that there's really nothing left that remains to happen before I return. I have predicted the destruction of Jerusalem, and I have said that one day I will return. When you see that destruction, then you will know that it is, that the end then is imminent. It could be at any time. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. What are these things? That these things are the things that he said, when you see all these things, recognize that he is near. In other words, the these things that he's talking about are the events surrounding the destruction of Jerusalem. Very simple then, this generation will not pass away. Was he somehow implying that he was going to come back within their lifetime? Or do we need to say that it's the generation that sees... You hear people argue something like, well, Israel became a nation in 1946 or 7 or whenever it was, and so it'll be a generation after that because Jesus said, this generation will not pass away. No, I think it's very much simpler than that. What was the question that they asked him at the very beginning? The temple's going to be destroyed? When is that going to happen? Here's his answer. This generation will not pass away before all these things take place. All these things that I'm saying, when you see them, are the sign that he is near and could come at any time. So, what's the answer to the question, when is Jerusalem going to be destroyed? Within a generation. This generation will not pass away. You guys will still be around when Jerusalem is destroyed the way I have predicted. And that's exactly right. That's exactly what happened. In 70 AD, the city was destroyed within the lifetime of many of the people that he was talking to. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. And when he speaks of that day and hour here now, I think he's talking about the final end, the end of the age. Because he goes on to say, for the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. So he's basically giving two answers here. In terms of the events that I have described of the destruction of Jerusalem, it's going to happen within your lifetime. But if we talk about that day when the end finally comes and the Son comes in His glory and finally brings this to a conclusion, no one knows when that is. I can't tell you that it's going to happen within a generation because no one knows when it's going to happen. I don't even know when it's going to happen, he's saying essentially. So, yes, within a generation, the events you have asked me about will happen. But in terms of when the Son is returning, who knows? I don't even know. And then I would argue that that is borne out by what we find as we go into the parables that follow in the end of 24 and into chapter 25. What is Jesus' main concern in what follows, really in this whole passage, to prepare his disciples for the fact that it could be a very long time before he comes back? Yes, the temple's going to be destroyed and is going to be within your lifetime, but if you ask me when is the Son of Man returning and when is this all going to wrap itself up, I can't give you an answer to that, but what I can tell you is you had better be prepared for it to be a long time. Okay, that in a hurried way is my understanding of the chronology of what it is that Jesus is describing here. That he's telling his disciples two very important things. That a very significant event in the history of Jerusalem was going to happen within their lifetime, and the return of the Son of Man, their great hope, the kingdom of God in its fullness was going to happen. Who knows when? God knows when, and nobody else does. Okay, so do you have a question quickly? about all of that? I know there's a lot there. Dale?
In verse 24, where it says, if it were possible, they shall receive the very elect. Do you take that to be saying that the false prophets and the Antichrist will not be successful in deceiving the elect?
I do. I think that's what he's implying. Well, what he's saying is that it's going to be so seductive that I think what he's implying is that it's going to be so powerful that the elect are only going to escape kind of by the skin of their teeth, in a sense, that it's the sort of thing that if it were possible for God to let go of them, that they would be gone, because this would easily suck them in. So he's warning about the attractiveness of it, but I think he is implying that the elect are in no danger ultimately. Margaret?
Paul talks about the partial hardening, so that when the fullness of the Gentiles is in, then all Israel will become believers, and then Jesus is going to come back. Jesus didn't mention this. I mean, he just is saying that it's going to be a long time, but he doesn't particularly say why it's going to be a long time. Should we understand that maybe Jesus did or did not know about this additional piece of information of why it would be a long time, or possibly he did, he just didn't know how long it was going to take for the fullness of the Gentiles to come in.
Right.
But this is new information that Paul is giving us, that Jesus is not alluding to at all in this.
Unless we take that language about Jerusalem being trampled underfoot until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled, if you connect those, the fullness of the Gentiles in Romans 11 with the times of the Gentiles in Jesus' language, then he may actually be alluding to it in that way, which I'm not sure about, actually. But okay, in the next couple of times that I'm going to be teaching, I want to take us into these parables in the end of 24 and 25, which are very important parables, I think. And now that we've sort of gotten past the who does what when part of it, I think we'll find that these parables actually hit home to us in our situation in a pretty striking way. So if you don't have any more questions, I think we'll stop.